Domisch. Today is January 30th, and I am in the office of Dr. Gabor Samardzai. Did I say everything correctly?
Gabor.
Yeah.
Gabor is Gabriel, you know, with the archangel.
Okay.
Gabriella would be the feminine name of the saints, and Gabor is the masculine part.
As I said, we like to start at the very beginning and hear from people a little bit about their childhood. And I know that you spent your childhood in Budapest. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that was like growing up in Budapest.
Well, you know, an American scientist reviewed my autobiography, describes all the essential features of my childhood. I was born into a middle-class family, and my grandparents on my father's side were originally from Austria, and then they moved to Hungary with the road building. My grandfather was a road builder for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Okay? And he fell in love with a Hungarian girl, and then it happened to two things. He converted from Roman Catholic to Jewish, mm-hmm. because she was in the family, and then they stayed in Hungary. But he never learned Hungarian. He spoke German, and they had five children. And as usual in those cases, his mother, my grandmother, died in childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the father alone raised the five children there. On my mother's side, the family was Sephardic. Originally, they were the remnants of the Spanish Jews that moved to the Turkish Empire and to the Saloniki, and so they were there. And as the Turkish Empire retreated and collapsed, they went north, and they went to first what is Transylvania today. It's called Erdély, and there is a big city there. Called Nagyvára, and then they moved to Budapest, and they started a business, a shoe business there, and so that's, they bought a family house, they built a family house in the 1880s, mm-hmm. so they were relatively successful with two shoe stores, and so it was a comfortable middle class existence, into which my father and mother got married in 1929. There's a picture of the wedding in the book.
Oh, okay? Nice.
And with the extended family around them. We lived in the same house, a family house on the second floor, and my grandparents lived on the first floor. And so it was comfortable. I was born in 1935. And for the whatever I remember, it was a very comfortable childhood until the anti-Semitic laws came into to Hungary, and my father, who was worked in a bank, which was an official of the bank, the Hungarian Credit Bank. That was a Rothschild bank originally, okay? And so when the Jewish laws came in, he lost his job, and then he opened a shoe store just like my grandfather, and my mother and father worked in that store as long as I remember, until my father was inducted in the Hungarian Army. 1940, I believe, 39 or 40. And then my mother ran the shop again, but our childhood did not changed much as far as I can see, except I had a German tante, so I spoke German fluently, but then the Jews couldn't have helpers of German origin, so it went away, but these are minor distractions from a lovely childhood until I was, I would say, 8 or so.
Now, was
just a second.
I just need to ask a question, I'm sorry. Do you want to have lunch with Chris Brooks, for instance? He says he was available.
Yes,
so
yes, I have to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Have to do that. We have to rewrite the proposal, probably. Okay. Thank you very much. Do you mind that I will not host you for lunch?
Not at all.
This is Honda, and the fund, a very nice chunk of research that they are interested in. He was here for 3 days, and I had no time to see. Okay, there we go.
I was going to ask, when you were young, perhaps before the anti-Semitic laws really came into effect, was going to temple and celebrating some of the Jewish traditions a large part of your childhood?
The Hungarian middle class, with that origin, were not very religious. Okay, they were much more Hungarians, just like the German Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was the demise of them, because when the Eichmann came and tried to put all the Jews in concentration camps, there were warning signs from the Polish Jews who came through and tried to escape, and came through Hungary. But the Hungarians never, the Hungarian Jews never believed that anybody would touch them, because they were so upright and embedded into the culture. Of course, they were wrong. And so, but there were a class distinction in many ways. Not only that, but there were layers of Jews. Sephardic was one, and my grandfather was on that side, and just normal, services, and we got together Friday evening for a meal with the family, and on celebration of holidays, and it was more of a social occasion than a religious occasion. So what's happening is that my father went into the Hungarian army, and immediately he was converted. A year later, he was converted from a soldier to a worker, a laborer, because of his Jewishness. And then he was sent to the Russian front, and these laborers were used to go through minefields. And as a result, he was a very lucky man, but out of 1,000, at the end, when they were retreating, and he was liberated in Mauthausen, which was an Austrian city, and by the American troops. And that was the end of the war, it was 45. And after a year and a half, he had typhoid disease, and totally very
sick.
Yes, So another lady came in, and she looks good. So he will be changing of the gods.
Yeah.
So then.
So I'm sorry, you said that your father at the end of the war, when he was liberated,
yes,
had typhoid.
Yes, and so after he showed up in Hungary, in Budapest, in a terrible shape, but my mother nursed him back to health, and then they started the business over for 2 years, and then the communists took over and they nationalized everything. And if you want to read that, this is described in details in my autobiography. Now,
may I ask if did the war disrupt? I'm sure it disrupted everything, but were you able to still attend school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The school, they sent me to an English school, a private school, and I had a sister, and we both went there, and we stayed in school until it was prohibited for Jews to go to school, and that was on the day, I remember everything vividly from that point on, March 19, 1944, the Germans occupied Hungary because the Hungarian dictator tried to change sides, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Germans knew it before anybody else. And they occupied Hungary, and at that point, Eichmann came in, and they had a full list of all the more prominent Jews. And I remember the day later, when they came in, Mercedes stopped, and the Gestapo was looking for my grandfather, who fortunately died 6 months before. Okay, and so they couldn't find him, but that information they didn't have. And so at that point on, our house was designated as a Yellow Star house because it was well known in Jewish ownership, and so we stayed there until we had a break because Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish, bribed the Germans with probably Swedish merchandise of importance, and he designated a few houses for a Swedish protection. And then we moved to one of those houses, which was in another part of Budapest, okay. And that's where we stayed until the Russians occupied. And the reason why the Jews in Budapest survived is that the Soviet troops surrounded Budapest, and then the Jews in Budapest could not be transported to Auschwitz. Okay. So that was the luck part.
And once you moved into this Swedish home from Wallenberg, did that offer more protection than?
Well, I mean, it was nominally under Swedish protection. And the Hungarian Nazis and the Germans, they knew that. But in every 2 or 3 days, a group comes in and line us up and to take us to the Danube. They were executing everybody. And then miraculously, Wallenberg showed up. And then we went back to the house for another episode like that to come. And we survived until finally the Soviets occupied the whole part of Budapest. And then we moved back to our house, the the old house, and life continued.
Did people seem happy when the Soviets came, that things were
better?
No,
the Russians were no friends. I mean, they didn't murder, but they took all the male members who were there, and there were some Jews, but not many, mostly the Hungarian population, and put them in trucks and shipped them to Russia. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they raped the women, and that was part of the occupation. But I don't want to go through the details of that, but what I vividly remember as a 9-year-old boy is the smell of my grandmother's body, because she died in this house, and we couldn't bury her for a week.
Oh, wow.
Okay, because there was nobody willing to take the body.
Yeah.
And then my mother managed to find somebody to take the body. And so it is a young child with experience. Okay, this is unforgettable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I didn't understand the procedure of decomposition.
Right.
As I do now.
So after the Soviets came, and as you said, you were going to school, did school again kind of change?
No, I changed. I changed. I had no interest. But during the Yellow Star period, we couldn't leave the apartment and our house. And there was a lovely old gentleman who was a relative, a distant relative, and he and I played chess every day. That was my morning exercise. We go down and play chess. And then the books, we had beautiful collection, both my grandparents and us, and I read every single side. And that was lovely. So when I went to school, I had absolutely no interest in school. And my mother was devastated. Okay. And I described this in the book, and she sent me to a psychologist, a child psychologist. What's wrong with him? And so the guy talked to me, and he found I had a spectacular understanding of literature and chess,
mm-hmm.
but he said he may be a historian, but he will never amount to science at all, no mathematics, no science. And so my mother was happy that I was still reasonably sane. And then slowly, I think it related to my father coming back. And suddenly, I came to realize that life goes on, and I became very good. Very good in science. I mean, in all the things that a boy of 12 would take. And I went to a school, which is a very famous school in Hungary, the Minta Gymnasium. It's an excellent school, school of excellence, in a street called Trefort. And this was the place where Edward Teller went. And von Karma, okay, because this was in Pest,
mm-hmm.
and that was in the upper middle class housing for upward mobile Jewish families, okay, and so we had our house there, and so Teller, of course, that generation of Jews Teller and Szilard and John Neumann, okay, came in the 1920s because of the anti-Semitic laws. They couldn't go to school. It was called numerus clausus, so it was a close number of Jews in proportion to their numbers in the population. Okay? And so the Jewish population was minuscule compared to the 10 million Hungarians, and so they were not allowed in their numbers who wanted to go. So that's why my father would never go to the university, but he went to what you would call now a business school, okay, the commercial school, and that's why he went to the bank. Okay. He was a genius in math. Okay. So by the time they got married with my mother in 1929, he was the director.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And so, but that lasted until 30. And then the army came, and the rest is history.
So, as you, after your dad came back, and you did start to kind of find your interest in school again, and your interest in things in general again, was it just history and chess that remained of interest to you, or did you start to find an interest in some of the sciences, math as your dad was interested in?
A good question. I was good at math and physics, but I have much more interest in history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I loved history, and I wanted to be a writer, and I started writing. And I had some very good teachers who did not discourage that. Okay. So I had a superiority complex that I can write better than any of my schoolmates. And I really wanted to go to the study, but it was obvious. I mean, many things happened. In 1948, the communists, they took over the government, and they nationalized everything. And the small shops that my parents had gone, okay? And my father, who was the bank director, a marvelous accountant, got into a small place as an accountant, a small so-called national, it was all state-owned, but it's a small manufacturing place, and he was the accountant. So that was our life. The store was closed, and I went to this very good high school. What did you ask, which I didn't respond to? No.
I was curious about the interest, if you had interest in science or if the interest in history was really overwhelming.
I had a Rákosi medal. Rákosi was the Hungarian dictator. Okay? And there was a medal for the best student based on examination. So I got that. But I was a good basketball player. That had lot of interest for me, and I discovered girls, and so we went out, very little money, but we went out, and I remember it was a dreadful habit, but it worked, is that we took a half a cup of melted butter,
mm-hmm.
and we drank it before going out to drink, because that coats the intestines, okay? And so the alcohol doesn't absorb so fast. And interestingly enough, much later, anybody who went to the Soviet Union, okay, got a briefing from the CIA that could be to take kefir, which is the buttermilk of the Russian Tsar, and do the same thing, drink a quart of kefir which again coated the intestines, and those days we had vodka, more tolerable results than that. So this is not just the Hungarian habit, but appears to show up in various situations.
So I'm just curious where, perhaps it was when you were in the school, the gymnasium, that you said was so highly esteemed. Perhaps you had a teacher in the sciences or the mathematics
yes.
who was
yes.
particularly
yeah.
helpful.
A physics professor, a physics teacher, it was excellent. But I really never thought of myself of going to sciences until I played good basketball, and so my father, through the basketball coach in my high school, got connection to the basketball coach at the Technical University. And so miraculously, I got admitted, even though I was a class enemy. You know what a class enemy is?
I don't.
You live a sheltered one. Class enemy in a communist country is one who is not a farmer, peasant, and not a worker, but everything else. Okay. The class enemy, it means that they don't fit into the regime, and they have to be watched and submitted to all sorts of hostilities. And so no class enemy, which means the middle class, okay, could be admitted to the university. But somehow, through this sport contact, okay, I was admitted. Okay. So I admitted and I went chemical engineer. So I listened to my father, and chemical engineering was the field. It was a technology by Caltech, MIT. So engineering was very strong. Okay. And so I went to chemical engineering. And of course, it was a planned economy. And so there was a plan, 5 years old plan, that you can graduate 50 engineers, chemical engineers a year, no more. But they admitted 200. Okay, so it was obvious that at the end of the fourth year, or the third year, the numbers had to be whittled down to 50. So it was a very competitive situation. And having been a class enemy, I had to be very good at Marxism-Leninism, which was the official. They were also a Russian language course around there, and so to translate science in Russian. And Marxism-Leninism was the essence of the teaching of the history of the Bolshevik Party. And so I had to take an exam, and I had to be very good at that. And it wasn't that difficult, okay? But I had to show that I'm not as much of a class enemy. And my science went back, the engineering went back, and I started to get interested in this. And I was good at it. And so, and then every summer we went to military service, okay, for 6 weeks, if I remember correctly. And so various parts of Hungary. And so that was a summer amusement. Okay. And then the school started. And then this happened until I got into the school in 1953. In 1956, I am in my fourth year. And that's when the revolution broke.
Well, before we get to that, I'd like to ask about some of the education experiences at the university. Especially since you were coming from this very highly esteemed gymnasium, how did the courses in the university seem? Were they particularly challenging, or Was it more of a challenge to keep proving yourself that you were going to be one of those top 50 graduates, that you belonged there despite being a class enemy?
Both. The first one, then, when I kept, I knew that they will not throw me out because the attrition was enormous, okay? So by the third year, we were down on 75, okay, from 200. And so I knew that I will make it because I have good grades and I was good at these things. And so that the communist side of this this sort of brainwashing treatment, it was unimportant. Every night we go home and then we close the windows and turn on the radio and listen to BBC or Voice of America. Okay. And everybody did that on the street because we could see the windows closing. Okay. There was nothing secret. Those who knew what's happened. And so I liked the laboratory courses. Not really challenging. It was a question of deciding what I want to do with myself. And I liked two fields. Neither one I knew anything about. This happens very often, and it's very important. One of them was polymers. I found them miraculous and it was interesting. And the other was catalysis. Again, I didn't know anything about either one, but it looked sort of magical. It caught my imagination. And then I knew that I will finish. And at that point, I had as much interest in girls as I had in the school, and that's how I met my wife. She was 3 years younger than I was. She was a high school student, and so we went out, etc., in a company of young people, and had a good time. And life was in a groove. Until, the Stalin died in 53, and by 56, Khrushchev came out against the Stalinist policies, and the Hungarian Communist Party became sort of restrained by the new politics. And so everything became... people didn't disappear anymore. It's the same thing happened. I was in a Humboldt, senior Humboldt fellow, in Berlin in February 1987. That's when the wall came back. And so I saw the same easing of the environment. So they don't shoot immediately, and people don't disappear. And they... life becomes normal, and then, as soon as that happened, the theaters and the nightclubs have stand-up cabaret people and personalities who were making jokes on the regime, okay? And that became almost a daily occurrence, and the jokes came out. I can tell you a few jokes like that, but a typical one is that two men were put into prison because they were telling, they were propagandizing that the Russians don't have enough to eat and ammunition, etc. Okay, so then the captain of the guard listened to that and said, "All right, I'll teach you a lesson," and he put the two guys up to shoot them. Okay, and he said, "Well, now I don't shoot you now, but when I hear that what you're saying again, I will shoot you. And so they let go. Okay, so they talk to each other. Look, they don't even have bullets anymore. A typical Hungarian show. Okay? There are many of these. So the regime started to not clamp down on resistance, passive resistance. And that became more active resistance, and by October 1956, the demonstrations demanded freedom and change of government, and the revolution started. And then it's on my fourth year. I was to get my diploma in December 54, but of course I never stayed until December. And then I participated in the revolution as well. The police disappeared, and so we were guarding the streets as, during the revolution. And of course, like stupid Hungarians would do, they always put together a list of people who did that. That was the most stupid thing you can do, because as soon as the Russians came back, which was 2 weeks later, okay, the list were telling them exactly who did what. But it sounded like a typical Austro-Hungarian behavior pattern. You know, you can laugh on these things, but it was not a laughing matter. So when my mother got a phone call that one of my colleagues at the university, who was also in the National Guard, my university student, the police started looking. Next day we left. And my parents sent my sister with us. And my girlfriend, her parents sent my girlfriend, so the three of us, to get trained toward the Austrian border. And the Hungarian trains were all strike, on strike, except they left, they went toward Austria. Okay? This was the sympathy. I mean, they knew that that's the only way to leave. And it was strange, going from Budapest to west. You know? And so we got on this train, and then at some point the conductor came. Next step, stop, the Russian troops are there. So anybody who doesn't want to go, get there, get off the train. So then at that point, we started walking in Western Hungary toward the Austrian border. Not even, it was sort of muddy and rain, actually, but it was walking during the night, and during the daytime, the local farmers took us in. And so daytime was spent in a farmhouse, and then at night we walked, with the help of some of the boys who were local.
Was it just the three of you walking, or
there were 15, 60 people which broke up and then separated, and then other people, so then we all put all our money into the hands of these peasant boys to help us to do that. So,
were you able to take much money with you from the Western Bloc?
No, about the Hungarian foreign, and enough that it was a remuneration for the services. They knew that we can not take the money out to Austria with Austrian shillings. I mean, so it's. We left all of that money as soon as we got to the border. But it was pitch dark, and the border is not straight. It goes by now. And so there was always a chance that we, instead of going through the border, we go backward.
Right.
And at that point, there were no, the searchlights were missing. Not all of them, but these boys knew exactly which searchlights were off. Okay, so that we could come because they knew where it was dark. Anyhow, we managed to come out.
How many days of walking and training?
Three nights. By the third night, we reached, fortunately, a Red Cross Austrian thing, and we got tea, and we knew that we were in Austria.
Now, when you reach Austria, you had mentioned at one point that at some points you had a German Tante.
I spoke no German whatsoever.
Okay.
I refused to speak German. You know, young boys are stupid. Okay. And because of all the things happened, I just absolutely refused to remember German.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then I forgot German because I did, you know, 45, I was 10 years old. And when a 10-year-old boy decides to do something stupid, it usually happens.
Was the rest of your schooling in Hungarian then?
Yeah. Hungarian, but we had to take, you know, the school that I went to had 8 years of Latin.
Okay.
And then, in the last 4 years, it was also 4 years of Russian.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Latin and Russian, okay, as a required subject, and I got grades in this. And German was not among them, so it was easy to avoid German.
Right. So when you reached the Red Cross camp in Austria,
yes.
Did you know what you were going to do next?
Yes, I knew that, you know, when you survive, okay, you start to believe in your judgment, because you survive. Okay. And then I made decisions for my sister and for my girlfriend and myself. And my father gave me a $20 bill when we left, okay, and he put it in a toothpaste, where the toothpaste could be opened from the bottom,
mm-hmm.
also in that, and so it squeezed out the paste and then put in a, with a plastic, a $20 bill, and then get the toothpaste back. Okay, and so I had $20, which I converted to shillings. That gave us enough money for a bus to Vienna. I knew that I didn't want to go to a family, but I wanted to go to Vienna and get out of Austria. And so that $20 got us there. So once we arrived in Vienna, there was another Red Cross thing. And then the International Rescue Committee, IRC, took over the refugees. That committee also helped Jews from the camp, concentration camp, to go to Israel.
Okay.
And then there were several, that was not a Jewish thing, but there was a Jewish agency who helped us, gave us some money, and the two girls went to where the nuns go.
The convent?
Convent. Mm-hmm. The convent, the women went to the convent. And I was put into the Studentenheim. You speak German?
I used to, so some of it's still there.
So that was a fraternity. And so we stayed. And it was a question of how to go to US. I decided that I want to go to the US. Then the story started, and the book described it much better than I can do it. One of the professors from Berkeley, Cornelius Tobias, was on a sabbatical here in the Karolinska Institute,
mm-hmm.
in in sleep, you know? And he came to Vienna to see whatever there was some help with Hungarian refugees. And he had a, you know, in this student mind, he had a little note that anybody who wants to go to the U.S., talk to Professor Kovarza. So I signed up and I talked with him. And then he knew that I would attend to engineering.
And so
and
close to graduating.
And he said, well, I have a brother who was also in the Technical University, and he is now a professor in of chemical engineering in Berkeley, mm-hmm. which was Charlie Tobias. And if you open the book for a moment, I'll show you the picture of Charlie. I didn't put in Cornelius because he was never a teacher for me. But you see the revolution. Okay, so this is Charlie Tobias, who was a professor here in mm-hmm. chemical engineering of Hungarian origin, and his brother was the one who we interviewed us, okay, in Vienna, okay, and so and then he gave me his address, okay. And this is Ken Pitzer, well, the dean of the college. And so then, when finally we made it, we got on a preference quota because we were students. And Eisenhower and the Senate gave a, I don't know, 50,000 special immigrant status because they felt badly because of the Israeli-Egyptian conflict at the same time. We didn't do anything for the Hungarians. Anyhow, we managed to get on that quota.
And this is you, your sister, and your girlfriend all managed?
No. My sister, I had an uncle in Chile.
In Chile?
In Chile. And, you know, girls are treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
Most Jewish families, I would say, but maybe other families as well as boys. And so they told my sister that if he made it to Vienna, she should make contact with my uncle in Chile and go to him. And so she was directed that way. And so, but I was not, and my girlfriend came with me,
mm-hmm.
and so we decided to go to the U.S., and so we got into this first preference quota with the World University Service, WUS, okay. And because we were students, and it was easy to get on the first preference.
Did you ever have, I mean, once you had this contact with Cornelius Tobias, it seemed like a given that you would come to the United States, but did you have any inkling that perhaps you would go to Great Britain or somewhere
no
else in Europe?
I had no interest. I wanted to come to the U.S.
Okay.
I didn't explore that, but there are many went to Switzerland. Many of the refugees went to Switzerland. Many went to England. And then many went to Australia and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think 100,000 Hungarians are straight.
Yeah.
Just because the Russians deliberately kept the borders open so the troublemakers leave. Okay, that they did that the same in 1968 in Czechoslovakia.
Yes.
Okay. And then they clamped down the border. Okay. So that helped us. But it was a very small time. By December 1956, the borders were closed. So we had a window. I think we November 25th or something like that. November when we crossed the border. So I have no idea where Berkeley is. I knew nothing about the schools in the United States. I didn't know it was a decent school or not. And so then we were put in a separate camp, waiting to get to the States, and a separate housing nice house. And then we were shipped by bus to an Air Force Army U.S. camp in Munich. Uh-huh. And we stayed there a day or two. And then we took a plane, a military plane, to Camp Kilmer, which is in New Jersey, where all the refugees were cleared for green cards. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And did your sister, while you were in Vienna, your sister made contact
with
your
my uncle?
Uncle.
And then she went to Chile, where my uncle, that's another unpleasant story, but by the time she got there, my uncle was bankrupt, with a business bankruptcy. Okay? So it was not very wholesome. Financially wholesome situation,
yeah.
But she was in Chile, okay. And we were in Camp Kilmer.
How did you go from Camp Kilmer? How did you make your way then to California?
Yes, but making from Vienna to Camp Kilmer, the single people were taken by boat, okay? And so, but we told them we would like to stay together. And he said, well, if you want to stay together, why don't you take a walk and come back as a married couple? That was the advice of the people, and that's exactly what we did. So we were allowed to take the plane from Munich, okay? And so we just came by plane and not by boat. So I started writing. We got our processing in green card there in the Camp Kilmer. And then Julie, my wife, she was put into the New York University dormitory because all the women students were there. And I was put into there's an international house, Columbia International, I'm not sure, the international house where the men were put. So we were in New York and I started writing for a job. And I took the letter of Charlie Tobias and I wrote it. And then the first letter, and I have the letters in the book.
Great.
Okay? One letter from Charles Tobias and the other one from Pitzer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pitzer accepting me on probation in Berkeley as a graduate student based on my 4th year status, okay? With $140 a month, which was $850 a semester. Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic amount. So, since that came first, I instantly accepted. Okay. Then the World University Service, the IRC, gave us a one-way ticket from New York to San Francisco. And Tobias was waiting us for the airport. So we were here, and we got he arranged also because I had money. I haven't had the money, but I knew that as of February, this month, the semester starts, that I would get money. And so I was in a house for a lady, and a few houses down, my wife, she was a high school student in Hungary, got a au pair position with a small room, okay, and staying with a lady. Okay. So that was the beginning.
Wow. What a...
But that's why I wrote the autobiography.
Yeah.
Because this is in this country you glorify the upward mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But there are reasons for it. Okay? And most of the American scientists have a background similar to mine, whether they come from China or they come from a European country or anywhere else. And so, but it's a given that I'm good in science, okay. But you need luck,
mm-hmm.
and you have to be healthy. Those are the most important things that you can have. And then you can talk about upward mobility.
I agree. I mean, after doing many of these interviews with scientists, many
yeah.
of whom have come from
strange background,
from other countries,
mm-hmm.
some through very straightforward immigration processes, some through less straightforward.
Right.
There is a lot of luck involved,
right.
and there is a lot of making contact with the right people at the right time.
Yes, and it's not predictable.
No.
At all. But the judgment comes in a big way. Okay? And so once you survive, and once you go to a good place, and you develop a self-confidence
mm-hmm.
in your own judgment, and it extrapolates to science. I know when I do something that I do. This is the most important step at that point, and but the dream is crucial. Okay, the strategy is what most people focus on. Okay? How do you get from here to the next step? But if you want to be a first-class scientist, on the very top, it is the dream that gets you. You have to have a dream, and you want to get there somehow. And it has to be a scientific dream. Okay. And when I interview new faculty, young guys, the question I ask, which is the hardest to answer, to ask these guys, all right, if you have the best students, all the money that you could ever use, the best equipment, what would you do? And you'll be surprised, maybe you will not be surprised, that most of them cannot answer. Because the thinking process is sort of snap up. How do I get my laboratory or the students? How do I have the money to do this? And so, the vision, I understand it's not there, but the dream has to be.
Right.
Okay? Because then whatever happens, you move toward the dream. And that's how we choose faculty. And I can tell you, the best people in sciences who are geniuses in experiments and write well and teach well, they will never make it to the top because they have no brains. And they take many things outside science because of this. They don't know really what keeps them in science. You know, I don't play golf. I mean, science is my form. This is my mind. Okay. And you know, it's easy for some to become a dean or a higher administrator or anything, or take another detour. There's nothing wrong with this. Okay. But the dream is missing, and the searching for something that is not an extrapolation of their science.
Do you think that when you started at Berkeley, you know, new to the United States, a refugee from Hungary, that you had this dream of upward mobility, that you knew that
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. However, it took a while to develop this, but subconsciously it's there, because I wanted to do catalysis.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what catalysis is, but it sounded good. Or polymers. And there was nobody in catalysis or in polymers in Berkeley. Okay? So I finally found a professor when I was finally accepted after my first semester, because I passed the courses, you know, and I was allowed to look for a professor. That inorganic chemist, Richard Powell, was willing to give me a catalysis subject, because he had students who were at Chevron, and they had catalysts, and then I had to find out why they collapse, or why they change in size, that had a major effect on the oil technology. And so I did small, so I did it. And then you find out that I was good at building instruments, I was good at doing experiments that have not been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's comfortable with that. But you have other motivations in life. I never made a penny until that, because I was in school in Hungary, living at home. I left and I made $140 a month. Okay. And by the way, we got married on the summer of 57, okay, because we were alone and it looked like the only thing to do. And so I never made a penny, and money was most important. Okay. So when I finished 3 years here, okay, because I had enough. Not only that, my professor never had anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to read, this is a Berkeley story, and this is a cathedral of science in the U.S. Okay, so what you will see is important. Okay. Half of the faculty worked on the Manhattan Project.
Right.
Okay, and Berkeley was a centerpiece. Oppenheimer, Teller, G.N. Lewis, and the atomic bomb research. The other half refused to get federal money because it will destroy the universities. The university's autonomy will be destroyed by the federal government. My professor was like that, and several very, very famous professors. Now, of course, they disappeared because they had no money, no students, and those who got federal money, you know, were winning out. And nowadays, everybody accepts that the federal money comes and supports science. You know? But at that time, it was not obvious. So I had no money. Every summer, I got 9 months salary. Every summer I had to work for 3 months in industry. Stauffer Chemical was here to get some money. And so, and I was teaching as a teaching assistant all 3 years in every semester, because my professor had no money. Okay? And I was sick and tired of teaching. The last thing I ever wanted to do was teach. And so I went for industry. And I took the highest paying job I could. That was IBM. I went to IBM. I got offered from DuPont, from all the oil companies, because my thesis was very much platinum oil related. And lots of opportunity jobs. I have a whole list at home of all the jobs. It's interesting, looking back, interesting. And so then IBM, I had 3 offers from DuPont, but I didn't want to go to a Wilmington was a company town.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it doesn't fit to my thinking, okay? And IBM had virtually no chemists.
Right.
So I thought, well, I'm going to beat the chemistry and I can learn solid state science. You can go into a new field. And IBM had, anyhow, so I took the job. It was a fabulous salary of $10,000 a year. Okay.
Now, before we talk about IBM, I'm curious, you said that, you know, when you left Hungary, you spoke Hungarian, Latin, and some Russian.
No Russian, but I could read Russian.
Okay.
Latin I never used.
Right.
Okay, of cultural benefits. Okay.
How did learning English go?
I had an English teacher, a lady taught very poor. My wife always half jokingly said that we have to take English for foreign students. Okay? She got an A, I got a C. She will never forget. And so but you learn, you have to learn. That much worse things happen. In Hungary, the examination, there are oral.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a style, there is a way of gaming the thing. You watch the facial expressions, the body language of the professor. And so when you go wrong with your answer, it shows. And so it's easy to change my story according to the body language of the professor. When you do written in the U.S., everything is written.
Right.
And not only that, but you have to know the theory, but to apply, because you have to solve problems. So it was very different ballgame. So, but I managed to learn that. But I lost my hair in the process. Not that it didn't start earlier, but I think that I definitely lost my hair. It was a tense situation, but I managed.
Was it difficult to make the scientific transition? You know, all of the chemical engineering that you've been learning.
Oh,
was
I left chemical engineering.
Okay.
Chemical engineering in Europe is mostly chemistry.
Okay.
Because the manufacturing prowess is not that high as the U.S. In here, the engineering is all applied mathematics, differential equations, how to build a reactor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's no chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I have absolutely no interest in differential equations and handle the chemical process of a black box, and you just do fluid mechanics and whatever. So I was given a chance of either chemistry or chemical engineering, because the two departments are in the same college.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately went to chemistry as soon as I listened to Leo Brewer, who was teaching thermodynamics, physical chemistry. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He was the one in the Manhattan Project who developed the materials to hold all the actinides, okay, plutonium, and all the isotopes. These are European salts, okay, and unbelievably good teacher. I loved physical chemistry. So I decided immediately to go to chemistry and not chemical engineering. And so after the first semester, when I took a unit operation course, I knew I don't want to be a chemical engineer. And the rest, you know, I went to chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Did you continue to have much contact with Charles Tobias?
Yes, okay. Yes. Well, over the year, it was a delightful time. But he was a chain smoker, and he died of emphysema that's one of the worst ways to die, because you suffocate. And so we were very good friends to the end. We were good friends, but there is a, how should I say, I had a hard time to call him Charlie, because there is a, this is not age difference, puts in a language that you respect.
Right.
So the same thing, I couldn't talk, that Dick Powell, my research director, as Dick. So it was always Professor Powers. So within these boundaries, I mean, we were very good friends, and I've done a fantastic amount from here that is second to none. Yorke had a way of choosing people who had dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important thing. And so I have 400 students and postdocs. Okay? At the end, you see all of their names. And that's the major thing that I teach them. I teach them instrumentation, synthesis, reaction studies, broadly. And science develops at the boundaries of fields. New science develops at the boundaries of fields. So if my student can do synthesis and reactions, they can put it together and do something unique, new science. And the same with instrumentation. So you teach that they don't stay in a groove, but they look for the edges, the boundaries of the fields. This is my last year, because I'm 78. Okay, so I am absolutely convinced that the fields of three fields of catalysis, heterogeneous, homogeneous, and enzyme, are the same. The same fields, it's just the way they work, the medium. You know, enzymes work in water, the heterogeneous are usually gas phase, and homogeneous is organic solvent. But they are all nanoparticles. And nanoparticles are very low coordination. You have lots of few number of nearest neighbors. And that is totally needed for catalysis, because everything has to be flexible,
right,
to do the catalysis. And all the nanoparticles, the enzyme, your body has 3,000 of those. They work, but under different conditions. And so once you have a dream like that, there is no question I will get to it, or my students will get to it. And you build up dreams according to what is not known. You never stay in the groove of known science if you ever want to be a leader of science. And so it comes. I mean, there is the history taught me a lot, because I see a pattern of success.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? The first 50 years of the 20th century was the atom, quantum mechanics, hydrogen bomb, atomic bomb, physics. Huh? The second 50 years, where we are here, is, I think, 57, the Sputnik, I would say, molecules, making chemicals, environmental manufacturing, or green chemistry, the biology, medical, and we had a 22-year increase in life expectancy. The quality of life is much, much higher than the first 50 years. And after the first 50 years, we were still one of the countries who were reasonably good in science. Now we're world class. There's no question that the first 50 years, and nobody writes about these 50 years, okay? Except some books like Andy Grove, who is my age and Hungarian, and he got his degree here.
Yeah.
He was unfortunately at the Parkinson's. Steve Jobs. The Steve Jobs story is fantastic. But he was on the technology side, okay? New products, but science-based, but new products. Right? So there are one or two books, but not much. This of my book is one of the first ones to focus on the 15-year of exponential growth of science, okay, which made the U.S. world class. Okay? There's no question that all my people post up from basically feel free of charge just to be here and take the knowledge that comes with it. But there is a reason. The reason is that and I wrote it two places, beginning at the end, the American federal money into science was $150 million in 1957 when Sputnik came. In 2012, the American investment in science, federally supported science, is $150 billion. So maybe I'm very creative, very productive, but I am working like the Renaissance on an exponentially growing funding. Okay? And that is unbelievably important. Okay? Now, I understand that my professor didn't want to take federal money and the word about the autonomy. I mean, there's a very good reason for this. But fortunately, it worked out fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the $150 billion is not that much money with the U.S., with, I don't know, $50 trillion budget. And the society got used to that science delivers longer life expectancy, more health, products. And so that happened in 1880 in Germany, when by distilling coal, the Germans, basically brown coal, the Germans discovered indigo and alizarin, and there was no reason for the British colonies to do that. They didn't bring in more money, and the colonial empire collapsed, except they sold opium to the Japanese for a while. Okay? But the whole culture changed, and it absorbed the scientific input in Germany and here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't talk about it, because there are also some political shenanigans going on, but the U.S. population is convinced the importance of science to their life, quality of life, okay? And that will not go away, at least not for 100 years. Okay? And that, historically, is the key change. And that was due to this exponential growth. Okay? You ought to look at the these are good numbers, okay?
It was interesting, a couple minutes ago, you were talking about teaching your students and having taught your students to try and pursue new science at the edges, pursue things that are at the boundaries of different fields.
Absolutely.
And I mean, of course, it's interesting because what you work on is surface science, so you're always
at
looking
the
at the surface, looking at the boundaries, whether it be in your actual field or on a higher level. I was curious, though, before we talk about IBM, because we were chronologically, that's where we were. You said that when you were working with Dick Powell, you discovered that you were good at building instruments and making kind of reactions work and go. And I was wondering what some of the instrumentation is that you started building.
Okay. To be in the cathedral of science, you immediately get a feel for the trends, because most people work at the frontier of their discipline. So now he suggested that I work with X-rays, small angle X-ray scattering, which had a way of detecting size of platinum particles as they grow during the catalytic industrial process. And they had no money, and so Professor Templeton, who was here but an X-ray diffraction, well-known person, gave me an X-ray machine to use. But I had to build the small angle X-ray thing, and then I built up that, and nobody has done here a small angle X-ray scattering, which is low angle, and that low angle gives the size of the model. So I put together the apparatus, and I had to work between midnight and 3 o'clock because the electricity was not stable, and the signal intensity was changing as the electric lines were going through voltage hiccups. Okay. And so I did that and did my pieces and in 3 years, and I found out that how to get these particles to see them grow, and I had to use a high pressure instrument to, after they grew, they are inside the mesopores, and the pores scatter X-rays. Mm-hmm. So I took a 100,000 atmosphere plunger, a high pressure anvil, which Professor Juro did here, okay, and then I squashed all the holes out of this, and so what gave the contrast is the metal particles. And so, okay, this was the idea of using new techniques to get to an important result. But, so I did it. But then it was obvious that the future, I was interested in catalysis. Because my project was, and I saw it useful, in my engineering background always, I'd like to be useful. Mm-hmm. So it happened, that I'd like to do now catalysis. But I learned that what is the future of physical chemistry is going to the atomic scale. And every new direction of physical chemistry pointed to that. Infrared spectroscopy by George Pimentel, laser came after I was at IBM. The X-ray diffraction is the molecular science. That was a time when the DNA was shown, okay, by X-ray diffraction. And the macroscopic properties of surfaces, the surface area, or just the reaction without knowing how it goes, okay, is not the future. So when I went to IBM, I didn't do any catalysis because I was learning how they make transistors and how I was put in a project to make a cheap computer, and this was before the integrated circuits.
Right.
Okay. By using a photoconductor luminescent material. Well, the luminescent material, it gives pulses of light, and then the photoconductor responds to that to make a cheap computer, and it worked, but it died. And so they asked me, why does that die? Okay, and I went to surfaces and I found that all these devices are small. Small because the electron has to go from one end of the device to the other one, and it has to be short as possible, and then the device is faster. So, and surfaces were the key. And the reason it died is because the surface, which was cadmium sulfide and cadmium selenide, was oxidized in air. And it became cadmium oxide, and it no longer was a photoconductor, okay, on a surface layer. And so I found this out, and found out that it's easy to repair, because all you have to do is encapsulate it with some glass or polymer or something, and it worked. However, then the device was not cheap enough,
right,
and so it was not enough. So I gained a great deal of reputation within the company, but the device, they decided it will not work. Okay. And you know, 4 years later, Fairchild came out with integrated circuit field, getting the transistors hooked up together, and we have now over 1 million transistors in my PC. So it was clear the surfaces were the key. And that device told me that I should do surfaces. There was no catalysis here, but surfaces. And so, as luck would have it, in Bell Labs in 1962 period, they discovered how to take electrons and using a television screen, they diffract it from a surface, and they can detect the structure of the surface with low energy electron diffraction. And that low energy electron diffraction was discovered in the 1920s, 27, it got a Nobel Prize in because it electrons diffract. That was the proof of quantum mechanics.
Okay.
And so, but it took so long from scattering the electron from the surface, a day or so, that the surface becomes contaminated. But in the meantime, the space sciences forced the evolution of vacuum, because space is in ultra-high vacuum, and you need pumps to create space environments, and you need it for transistors, because the surface, as it got smaller, the surface was everything, okay? Needed a way to clean up the transistor, the silicon and the germanium. So ultra-high vacuum was evolutionary developed because of space sciences, and the transistor taking over as an amplifier from the radio tube. Okay? Now, so I decided I have to work on surfaces, because that's the way that these devices go. And then in IBM, that was a discovery of the solid state laser. You know, when you have green
laser pointer,
mm-hmm. It has a solid diode laser,
right.
Okay? And so the green and the red, and then that was gallium arsenide, it was discovered there. And so it was obvious that these diodes are smaller and smaller, so surfaces were accessible. So I went to Bell Lab, a visit, and find out how they do this television projection of the electron diffraction within a microsecond.
Do you remember who you talked with?
Yeah. The Germer, Lester Germer, was, by the way, it is in the István Kárgitai, I think, description of it. Lester Germer was the original guy who worked with Davison, who got the Nobel Prize in 1927. But he stayed at Bell Lab, and he just decided that the television, which came now into understanding use, okay, is a nice way of projecting fast the signals. Okay. So I saw it, how they did it, and commercially it became available, and I pursued the idea to buy the first commercial machine to do that. And I thought this is my future, because it had an atomic level study of the surface. This is what was missing from surfaces. Surfaces stayed in the Middle Ages because the few atoms the surface had could not be studied with atomic level techniques. And so they studied the adsorption and the flow of gases, but these are all macroscopic things, they're not molecular. Right? So this got me, and IBM got me the machine, the first commercial available. And then my manager called in and said, well, you're doing fine, and so I will promote you to be the manager of 3-5 crystal blocks, gallium arsenide, indium arsenide. Sorry.
No problem.
And so I said, well, you know, thank you very much, but I want to do surfaces, right. And now we have a machine, and I really think I can do lots of good things. He said, thank you very much. You will be the manager as of next week. It was obvious. They wanted to put me in a place where they make more money from my talents, and it's not not a bad thing, but it was a shock to me that I will not do that, and I don't want anybody to tell me what I should do, and I have to leave.
And this promotion would have been the point where you left the lab.
Not necessarily,
okay.
But as you might know, from a research lab, the young researcher who is his talent can be used to make some useful device somewhere else, and so you move into the processing mode, and but that was not the issue. That was really the big research laboratory in Yorktown Heights. When I went to IBM, within a year, they built that laboratory.
Okay.
I started in Poughkeepsie, and then I moved over there. And by the way, my wife went to, when we were in Poughkeepsie, she went to Vassar to finish.
Oh.
Because I finished before she finished undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so when I got the job in Poughkeepsie, she went to Vassar and finished.
Right.
Then she worked at IBM computing for a while until the children were born. So it was obvious that I had a career path, that it was an industrial career path. I was not about to accept what they wanted me to do, because I wanted to do surface science with a new machine that give me atomic level view of the surface. So I started to look for a job. So I got lots of rejection, lots of acceptances. And among them, Berkeley gave me both an offer in chemical engineering and chemistry, and Caltech, Davis, Teller had a Davis department there, so I decided to, when I got the offers from Berkeley, I wanted to come back. And so I accepted the job, and I come back to Berkeley with a little baby, 3 weeks old, and my daughter. We have two children, my daughter and then a son, 2 years younger. So, but I was not allowed to take the machine with me, so the first thing I did, I got Berkeley to buy me a machine, the one and only I bought, and I built another 25 machines like that in-house, because it was much cheaper. I had a fantastic technician, a Hungarian guy who immigrated after spending 3 years in a camp in Russia. After the war, he was trucked over there, but in fact, Imre Kozak, he died recently, and so he built my machines here, and so I started my laboratory teaching.
Let's take a quick break before we start talking about your
ladies' room is at the end of the corridor.
End of the corridor.